This is May 1st, 2016. We're now 2 months from our 50th anniversary. More and more time is being used here at the center during the day in planning for that 50th anniversary. So stay tuned. I'm going to read an article from Tricycle magazine. It's called Tricycle, the Buddhist Review. It's one of three or four national quarterly magazines devoted to Buddhism, Buddhist teachers and practices and all. This is the winter 2015 issue. And the article is called 17 Frank Pieces of Life Advice from a Zen Master. And this is by a Kodo Sawaki Roshi. And first, there are a few paragraphs about him, this unusual teacher. His dates are 1880 to 1965. He was came to be known as Homeless Kodo, which, and there'll be more about that in just a bit further down here. He was one of the most influential Soto Zen teachers of the 20th century. He was orphaned in early childhood. He ran away from his caretaker at the age of 16 to become a monk. Not long after he was ordained, he was drafted into the Japanese Army and served during the Russo-Japanese War of 1904 to 05. When the war concluded, he returned to his practice of Zen and eventually took responsibility of Antaiji Dojo in 1949. Antaiji is one of the very few Zen temples in Japan that seem to accept Westerners for training. Sawaki was by no means a conventional abbot, however, and instead of attending to administrative duties at the temple, he roamed around the country of Japan in order to teach Zazen, of course, Zen meditation, to lay people, which is an endeavor he dubbed the Moving Monastery. His efforts both earned him the nickname Homeless and established him as a pioneer of the repopularization of sitting practice within Japan. Makes me think of one of the most astounding things I ever have learned about Zen in modern Japan, which is that at most Zen temples, they don't sit. I read this in a book called, I forget the name of it now, but it was written by an American Zen nun who had lived in Japan for like 30 years. So I take what she says with authority, and I've never heard anything to the contrary, but that most Zen temples, and there are hundreds of them in Japan, don't offer sitting. Which is it's flabbergasting. The word Zen means meditation. So, some of you are asking, what do they do? Well, they do funeral and memorial services, and which are very lucrative. That always for a funeral and memorial service, the family of the deceased makes handsome donations. And that enables them to maintain the temple, repair it, and keep it going. But the whole heart of the matter has been drained out by just doing these. When I read this, then it made more sense to me what I had read in the Three Pillars of Zen, where Yasutani Roshi said that most Zen priests in Japan are just glorified funeral directors. But to continue here, What follows here in the magazine is an abridged version of a collection of his sayings called To You, which were compiled by Sawaki's successor, Uchiyama Roshi. And then one more paragraph about him. Sawaki is especially known for his nomadic lifestyle and for emphasizing the importance of meditation over the study of texts or working with koans. Well, that would place him in the Soto school. And Soto school, generally speaking, with some exceptions, in the Soto school, koan study is not offered as it is in the Rinzai school and in our own here. If his words here are any indication, however, he must also be remembered for his charismatic and direct style of communication, which can sometimes border on the irreverent. Are you worried about your career, fighting with your spouse, complaining about how busy you are? Homeless Kodo has a piece of advice for you. We just can't guarantee it's the advice you'll want to hear. So there's 17 points here. We don't have time to read all of them, but I'll just start with number one. To you who have just begun brooding over life. And this is what he says. In a part of Manchuria, the carts are pulled by huge dogs. The driver hangs a piece of meat in front of the dog's nose, and the dog runs like crazy to try to get at it. But of course he can't. He's only thrown his meat after the cart has finally reached its destination. Then, in a single gulp, he swallows it down. It's exactly the same with people and their paychecks. Until the end of the month, they run after the salary hanging in front of their noses. Once the salary is paid, they gulp it down, and they're already off, running after the next payday. Nobody can see farther than the end of their nose. He poses a question. The question is, why are you straining your forehead so much? This, I have to be careful about interpreting Japanese idioms because I've spent so little time there and speak no Japanese. But I spent enough time there to hear bits and pieces of kind of the general ethos of Japanese culture. And one is that it's considered impolite to show furrows in your brow, so like show surprise in your forehead. It's intriguing that, and if you start to notice that Asians generally, I think, have smooth, they've cultivated smooth foreheads. Here, why are you straining your forehead so much? It suggests that he's saying, why are you grasping after something, straining to get something? That's really the point of it. Then he says, if you aren't careful, you'll spend your whole life doing nothing besides waiting for your ordinary person hopes to someday be fulfilled. Ordinary person is probably a kind of literal translation of your delusion, your deluded hopes of someday being fulfilled. This analogy of the his example of running after the next payday. I think what seems more common to me is people who are live from one weekend to the next. They just want to fight their way to Friday, so then they can have their weekend, and then the next day it starts up again. It's got to be a better way of living than that. being so alienated from your work that you pretty much live for the weekends. Maurice Sendak, the author of Where the Wild Things Are and other children's books, he said it very nicely. He said, there must be more to life than having everything. Number two, to you who can't stop worrying about how others see you. And then he says, you can't trade even a single fart with the next guy. Each and every one of us has to live out his own life. Don't waste time thinking about who's most talented. The eyes don't say, sure, we're lower, but we see more. The eyebrows don't reply, sure, we don't see anything, but we are higher up. The nose can't replace the eyes, and the mouth can't replace the ears. Everything has its own identity, which is unsurpassable in the whole universe. There's a Yiddish saying, if I am like him, who will be like me? One way to understand our work in Zen practice is to become authentically who we are, which means, first of all, to be uniquely, distinctly who we are, which is going to be different from anyone else in the world. It also means to be authentically, to live up to our true self, this self that is no self, this no self of wisdom and compassion and virtue. Three, to you who are totally exhausted from fighting with your spouse. The question isn't who's right. You're simply seeing things from different points of view. It all begins when we say, I. Everything that follows is illusion. Stop trying to be something special. Just be what you are. Hold fire. Just sit. My wife, who's a clinical psychologist, sometimes sees people who are in going through rough marriages, and they describe the kinds of conflicts that are kind of part of marriage, about who's right and who's wrong, and she will sometimes tell them, "What is more important to you? To be right or to maintain a relationship with your partner?" It's really worth reflecting on when we find ourselves caught in one of these repetitive battles over this thing or that thing. I would propose that it's the same in a wider sense with partisan politics. To use his words, you're simply seeing things from different points of view. I've read that there is research that shows that to some extent, our political affiliation is based on things completely out of our control, not just our parents' political affiliation, that's something else, but brain wiring, our brain wiring can affect our political affiliation and beliefs. They've even found that Republicans and Democrats have some kind of connection with the olfactory organ, sense of smell. I think it can really help if you're getting into hair pulling with someone of another political beliefs, to just exhale and recognize that to a large extent, our beliefs, our opinions are not reasoned. They're the product of causes and conditions that, to some no small extent, are beyond our control. Hold fire. Just sit. 4. To you who think there's something to being in. You're always hanging on to others. If somebody's eating French fries, you want French fries too. If somebody's sucking on a candy, you want a candy too. If somebody's blowing on a whistle, you scream, "Mommy, buy me a penny whistle too." And that doesn't just go for children. When spring comes, you let spring turn your head. When autumn comes, you let autumn turn your head. Everyone is just waiting for something to turn their head. Some even make a living turning heads. They produce advertising. One at a time, people are still bearable, but when they form cliques, they start to get stupid. They fall into group stupidity. We live in group stupidity and confuse this insanity with true experience. I'd like to think that he is also referring here to the mania, that mass psychosis that swept through Japan and led them into invading so many other countries in Asia. And for World War II, we live in group stupidity and confuse this insanity with true experience. It is essential that you become transparent to yourself and wake up from this madness. Zazen means taking leave of the group and walking on your own 2 feet. Here too, there's been so many experiments done in social psychology that show how weak we can be when action is called for, and we become paralyzed. There's a kind of group paralysis where no one responds to what needs to be done. When someone is in need and someone needs help, or say bullying, all too often no one has the fiber, the independence to step forward and step out of this group paralysis. It's hard. That is also part of our wiring, is to not want to disaffiliate from groups. But there's a time to do exactly that. Five, to you whose life is about money, money, and more money. Human happiness and unhappiness doesn't only depend on money. If the balance in your savings account were a measure of your happiness, it would be a simple matter. Yet, it really isn't so. Don't Don't be so helpless that you start saying you need money to live. In this world, you can lead a fine life without savings. This reminded me of a wonderful passage by Zen Master Dogen, 13th century Japanese Zen Master Dogen. This is from a book called A Primer of Soto Zen, which is a translation of Dogen's Shobogenzo Sui Monkey. And this has sustained me throughout my life. It's just so profound. I wish that everyone could embrace this. It's quite short. He says, he's speaking to his monks, granted, but it goes, I'm convinced that it's beyond the monastic life. He says, each person naturally receives his allotted share in life. He need not think of it. He need not search for it. The allotted portion is there. Even if you rush about in search of riches, what happens when death suddenly comes? Students should clear their minds of these non-essential things and concentrate on practicing the way, the Dharma. So many people suffer from anxiety about money. And yes, people, householders have bills to pay, and this can naturally be a problem. Bills have to be paid. But beyond paying bills, how much money do you think you need to be happy? There's a charming story about this. From this collection of stories called Soul Food, Stories to Nourish the Spirit and the Heart. And just the original title was Stories of the Spirit, Stories of the Heart. They changed the title. And this is edited by Jack Kornfield and Christina Feldman. Here's the story, short. The rich industrialist from the north was horrified to find the southern fisherman lying lazily beside his boat smoking a pipe. "Why aren't you out fishing?" said the industrialist. "Because I have caught enough fish for the day," said the fisherman. "Why don't you catch some more?" "What would I do with it?" "Well, you could earn more money. With that, you could have a motor fixed to your boat to go into deeper waters and catch more fish. Then you would make enough money to buy nylon nets. These would bring you more fish and more money. Soon you would have enough money to own two boats, maybe even a fleet of boats. Then you would be a rich man like me." "What would I do then?" "Then you could really enjoy life." "What do you think I am doing right now?" Six, to you who would like more money, love, status, and fame. He says, stupidity means being preoccupied with your own body. Wisdom says, I am what I am no matter how things end up. Once during the war, that is the Russo-Japanese War, I visited a coal mine. With the same outfit and headlamp as the miners, I got into the lift and down we went. At one point when we were going down, it seemed to me as if suddenly we were going up again. But when I looked with the lamp at the wall of the shaft, I saw that we were still going down. In the beginning, when we were accelerating downward, we could really feel that we were going downward. It was only when the velocity changed that it seemed to us as if we were going up again. In exactly the same way, when we think about our lives, we always go wrong when we mistake the fluctuating amounts for the sum. This is a fundamental lesson that comes from Zen practice, that everyone learns if you do it long enough, which is that we have to detach from the short-term appearance of progress or lack of progress. This is one of the most difficult things for people to learn, and most important. There will always be periods where things are going better in our practice. Our concentration is smoother, deeper, and that'll be followed by periods where it is less so. And if we react to these changes, then we will be left ungrounded and potentially discouraged. Seven, to you who would like to leave your rivals in the dust. We often wonder who here is really better, but aren't we all made out of the same lump of clay? Everyone should sit firmly anchored in the place where there is no better and worse. Your whole life, you're completely out of your mind because you think it's obvious that there is a you and the others. You put on an act to stand out in a crowd, but in reality there's neither you nor the others. Buddha Dharma means seamlessness. What seam runs between you and me? Sooner or later we all end up acting as if a seam separates friend and foe. When we get too used to this, we believe the seam really exists. So yes, we are different. Any two people are different. Every one of us is distinct. But different doesn't mean separate in any fundamental way. Poor and rich, important and unimportant, none of that exists. It's only glitter on the waves. Eight, to you who are sobbing because somebody's put one over on you. All beings are mistaken. We see as happiness that which leads to unhappiness, and weep over an unhappiness which isn't unhappiness at all. We all know the child whose tears suddenly turn into laughter when you give him a cookie. What we living beings call happiness isn't much more than that. At some point, you've got to slap yourself in the face and seriously ask yourself, is your personal gain or loss really worth this overwhelming joy and suffering? Sooner or later, everyone starts thinking of nothing besides themselves. You say, that was good. But what was good? It was only good for you personally, that's all. A person with big desires is easily fooled. Even the greatest con man can't profit from a person with no desires. This idea of no desires, having no desires, is one that is really sticks in the craw of people who don't understand Zen teaching or the Dharma. Of course we have desires. If we're cold, we have a desire to get warm, and vice versa. To get comfortable, desires for comfort, for food. many other desires, that the point in this, the Dharma, is not to be attached to these desires, not to be attached to them. They come and go. We gain things, we lose things. Oscar Wilde said, there are two disappointments in life, not getting what you want and getting what you want. Because it's never enough. It's never lasting. There's a Spanish proverb, there is no happiness, there are only moments of happiness. To a person of a certain temperament, this sounds so bleak. And why would anyone want to subscribe to a teaching that says that there's no happiness, there are only moments of happiness, and so forth? But it's not until we come to terms with that, not until we squarely face that fact, that it's just a matter of time. It's just a matter of time before something else will come around the bend and knock us off balance. Some changing circumstance or condition, some loss. So we had better, the only intelligent thing to do is to make peace with that and realize that grasping after some steady state of happiness is crazy. It's delusion. And that's where the practice comes in, the meditation, is we learn from day to day, week to week, month to month, that things come and go, that we can weather the pain, the painful circumstances, and find a new, deeper sense of equanimity, of balance. Nine, to you who are tumbling down the career ladder, when you're dead and you look back at your life, you'll see that none of this mattered in the least. Fortune and misfortune, good and bad, not everything is how it looks to your eyes. It's not how you think it is either. We've got to go beyond fortune and misfortune, good and bad. Suffering is nothing more than the suffering we create for ourselves. We create for ourselves. It's in the mind. We create suffering by misusing our minds, by dwelling in our thoughts, clinging to the past, dwelling in memories, dwelling in thoughts about the future. That's suffering. 10. To you who are complaining all the time that you haven't got any time. I think this is very common these days. We touched on it last week in last week's Teisho. But he says, everybody complains that they're so busy that they haven't got any time. But why are they so busy? It's only their illusions that keep them busy. A person who practices Zazen has time. When you practice Zazen, you have more time than anyone else in the world. If you aren't careful, you'll start making a big fuss just to feed yourself. I'm reminded of an article someone passed me recently that showed there was a survey they were curious about sales figures that showed that breakfast cereal sales of breakfast cereal were declining, and they investigated it and they found that millennials, those of the millennial generation, are eating less breakfast cereal than their predecessors, young people from the past. And the reason they gave was that it takes too much time. Yeah, it takes too much time. You gotta open the box. and not to mention having bought it in the first place. But you got to open the box, and then you got to get the milk out of the refrigerator and pour it on the cereal. He says, you're constantly in a hurry, but why? Just to feed yourself. Chickens, too, are in a hurry when they peck at their food. But why? Only to be eaten by humans. I wish I could have met this guy. How many illusions does a person create in their lifetime? It's impossible to calculate. Day in, day out. I want this. I want that. Just a single stroll in the park is accompanied by incalculable illusions. So that's what it means to be, quote, busy. I want to be with you. I want to come home. I want to see you. In other words, wanting to be somewhere else than where one is, or with someone else instead of with whom one is. The Buddha said there are four kinds of suffering in this life. Not being able to do what you want to do, having to do what you don't want to do, being apart from people you want to be with, and having to be with people you don't want to be with. And then he finally says, people are constantly out of breath from running so quickly after their illusions. 11. To you who wish you could lead a happier life. He says, rest a while and everything will be fine. We simply need to take a short break. This just came to me. Pascal said, all of the unhappiness of man is that he's not able to sit quietly in his own room. We simply need to take a short break. Being Buddha means taking a short break from being a human. Being Buddha doesn't mean working your way up as a human. Little comment here. Buddha, remember, means aware in its most basic sense. Buddha means awareness. So let's plug that in. Being aware means taking a short break from being a human. Here what he means is human as one of the six realms of unenlightened existence. Human, if you think of human as defined in terms of dissatisfaction, of dukkha, frustration, anxiety, this is the sort of defining characteristic of what in Buddhism historically has been called the human realm. There's the hellish realm, the hungry ghost and thirsty spirit realm, animal realm, human realm, the fighting demons realm, and the heavenly realm. But humans, our predicament as human beings is coming to terms with dissatisfaction. And nothing is ever quite going to be satisfying in any ultimate way. Or to think of it another way, frustration. Frustration in small ways as well as large ways. So he's saying that being fully aware, being being free of thoughts. That means taking a short break from being a restless, grasping, never satisfied human. And then he says being Buddha, being aware, doesn't mean working your way up as a human. And then he says, he quotes someone by the name of Kyuho, what sort of person stands on the ground where there's neither coming nor going? No, excuse me, this must be some kind of a koan. And then the answer comes from Kyuho. The stone sheep versus the stone tiger. Sooner or later, they'll get tired of staring each other in the eyes. And then he kind of explains a little bit. The stone sheep won't flinch. The stone tiger won't jump out of hunger. That's the point. Encountering things beyond thinking. What do we have when we truly have a grip on things as they are? Beyond thinking. That's the this translator's rendering of that. Beyond thinking. I think a better one is no thought or no mindedness. No thought doesn't allow itself to be thought. No matter if you think so or not, things are simply as they are. To practice the way of Buddha means to completely live out this present moment, which is our whole life, here and now. Yeah, maybe just one more. Twelve, to you who want to study a little Buddhism to improve yourself. In this same issue of Tricycle, there's a whole section of series of articles about self-improvement. And one, a short one, that I'll read just the beginning of. It's called The Best Self-Help Tip Ever by Amy Gross, who's a contributing editor to the magazine here. She says, someone asked me recently if I had any tips for maintaining calm and adapting to change. Quote, even if I can't meditate frequently. This reminded me of one of my big questions in life. How can I get fit and strong without exercising? The moment was an epiphany. I saw in a flash the lure of the self-help culture, the promise that everything can be made easy, a piece of cake. All you need is the right tip. But here's the catch with tips. If you want to improve your golf stroke or buy a cheaper airline ticket or find the best tacos in town, go ahead, ask around for a tip. If you're attempting something more ambitious, say, how to adapt to change? A tip isn't going to cut it. Think about the weight loss wing of the self-help industry. The tips keep coming. The industry flourishes. We lose some pounds, gain back what we lost, plus a few more, and go back for the next tip. How we eat, how we react to life's pinpricks and tectonic shakeups. These are well-worn grooves in our mind, and we can resist them for only so long. We expect the power of will to, poof, make us perfect. Yet willpower is an unreliable and limited source of energy. We return defeated to the old ways with deeper disappointments in ourselves. The truth is that changing a habitual way of being is a huge challenge. Rome wasn't built in a day, neither is calm. Rome wasn't built with twigs. Calm isn't built with tips. It's not that we can't help ourselves. We can learn to maintain calm, to roll with change when change rolls in. We just have to acknowledge, even honor, the scale of the adventure before us. It requires nothing less than rewiring our own brain, or rather, allowing the mind to be rewired by mind training, by meditation. It untangles us. Gradually, it replaces ancient patterned reactions with fresh and appropriate responses. This is why it's called practice. It takes time and effort, but to an amazing extent, we find ourselves helped. Practice changes our relationship to what would otherwise be upsetting. Facing change, we see how futile and painful it is to try to hold on to what is passing, which is everything. Compassion washes in with a kinder, truer understanding of why people do what they do, and that includes you. Things seem simpler, easier. The self-help mentality is a matter of shopping, accumulating tips. We don't have to go shopping. We just need to sit back and let practice work on us. We don't need tips. We need patience. We need equanimity. How to develop these qualities? I have a great tip for you. Meditate. Start now, continue forever. Stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot karma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attend all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot darkness beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.